Hello, this is Janet Gowan from Love Letters Live. And love letters, as you know, I think is a wonderful way of life. If you feel something positive, why not write it down, stamp it, and mail it to someone to make somebody else's life better? And yours too, by the way, just for having had the opportunity to bathe in some moment of positive. I'm going to our guest immediately, and it is Hugo Campos, who has gone through a remarkable through a remarkable and difficult journey that I thought we would like to share. Hugo, would you just talk about what you've been through? And this has to do with a pacemaker that you had implanted. How long ago?
November of 2007. And so it's actually not...
5 years now.
Almost 5 years.
Yes.
Now. So it's not quite exactly a pacemaker. It's an implanted defibrillator.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. Yes, I knew that.
Right.
Yes.
So it's a little different because the pacemaker regulates slow heart rhythms and the defibrillators regulate fast heart rhythms.
Yes, of course. Okay. So what has been the, I know one of the issues was that you couldn't get information about it that you wanted.
Right.
And I guess you felt that the arrogance of the medical profession in leaving you out of your own body, you know, what's important, it was just awful, which it is.
Right.
Now, what was the point of their secrecy? Do you know?
I wouldn't put it exclusively on doctors or clinicians. It really is just the way kind of things are with medical device companies, and it really is more. I would put a little bit more of the blame on medical device companies.
Okay.
I would say
so. It's not just the doctors who are keeping it private.
Right.
Okay. So my apologies to the doctors.
Right. Well, we all have the right to access our health information once it's guaranteed by HIPAA. Once the information is in your medical record, you do have the right to access information.
Yes.
So, but with implantable defibrillators or pacemakers nowadays, and I suppose most implantable devices that have electronics in them.
Yes.
The information is collected remotely with this what they call remote monitoring.
Now, when you say the information, you mean the information about what this defibrillator is doing as it's in you.
Right. The device is quite sophisticated. So it's got a computer in it and several chips. And what it does is that it looks at what it does in terms of regulating your heart rhythm, therapies that it delivers, which is basically shocks to the heart or pacing, and it also looks at its own function and what it does, and so that is the information that I'm referring to. So this data and this is transmitted remotely to a manufacturer that is.
So this is not in your medical records,
right? And that is why we stand in this kind of gray zone.
So. And what you want to do is change this so that you can get the information no matter where it's stored, since it's your body?
Right, right.
Sounds reasonable?
Right. Nothing about me without me.
Oh, good. Oh, would you just say that again nice and slowly? I like that so much. I'm going to cry.
Nothing about me without me. And this should be the mantra for every patient, right?
Yes.
I mean, you should be the one empowered and in charge of your health information and in charge of managing your health. After all,
you kind of have to be these days.
You have to be, yeah.
Right.
And we are considered to be responsible adults to care for every aspect of our lives, right? We manage our finances. We manage our careers.
Mm-hmm.
We manage our professional lives. Why not? Why somehow we're incompetent when it comes to managing?
Well,
our health?
So that's my question. Is there, what is the motivation for not letting you have information? Are they afraid of lawsuits?
I think it's one of the concerns. There are several concerns, and medical device companies have some concerns. Doctors have other concerns. And for example, medical device companies think that patients wouldn't understand the information.
Well, if they wouldn't, then they could go ask for an explanation from someone.
Right, exactly. And it's like saying, well, I won't give you a book because you don't know how to read. I mean, how am I supposed to learn how to read?
By the way, they're perfectly comfortable giving you your PG&E statement and your telephone bill
Right.
Which, as far as I can tell, nobody can read.
Right.
So,
right.
Yes.
Right. And it should be the right of the patient to decide whether or not I'm interested in taking an active role in my care.
What will it benefit you to know about everything regarding this defibrillator?
There are many benefits. Like one of them, for example, in my case, mm-hmm. I have paroxysmal atrial fibrillation, which means that the upper chamber in my heart, uh-huh. the atria, uh-huh. Beats erratically sometimes, and not all the time. Mm-hmm. Some people are in chronic atrial fibrillation. In my case, I have paroxysmal, which means that it comes and goes.
And it would be dangerous without this defibrillator.
Not specifically, but the danger with atrial fibrillation is the formation of a clot and having a stroke.
Oh.
So the device knows, it's in there, and it knows when I'm in atrial fibrillation and when I'm not. So, but I don't, because I don't have access to that level of information. So if patients would know this, they could take some steps, like, for example, taking an extra aspirin or doing something to mitigate the risk that they're
So you'd like this information somehow to feed into some receptive device that you have also.
Right. I want access to as much information as my doctor has access to me. And I want to be in control of that information as
sure.
well.
Sure. But your doctor has that information automatically? No, because it's not in your records.
Right. So the way it works is the data is collected wirelessly
uh-huh.
from the body of the patient,
right.
through a box that sits next to the bed and it's the patient's bed. So it's a remote monitoring unit, which
uh-huh.
kind of looks like a small cable box or
mm-hmm.
a Wi-Fi router,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like that.
And
so
evidently, it works when you're not home.
It expects you to be nearby, so
uh-huh.
it's programmed. Depending on the device, it works a little different depending on the manufacturer. But in my case, the device looks for my pacemaker or my implantable defibrillator at every night at 3 a.m.
Oh, I see.
Because it expects the patient to be
next
to it.
Does it get a full day's information at 3 a.m.?
It's not quite how it works. The way it works is like this. The device may initiate the transmission if there is an alert.
Uh-huh.
So if it notices there is some problem with the patient. Or the patient can initiate the transmission by pressing a button and saying, oh, I felt something. I'm not feeling too well. I don't know what it is
uh-huh.
because I have no access to any of the information.
Yes.
But I'm going to push this information to my doctor. And you press a button, and that information is transmitted to the manufacturer of the device, who then makes it available to the doctor.
This is just dizzyingly interesting.
Right. And the third option is when the doctor pulls the information. So that's the third way in which the data is transmitted. The doctor actually
How does he get it?
Like they get it on their they usually get it on their computer.
Oh, of course, yes,
right, on their desktop computer.
Right.
So there are many choices nowadays for alerts because doctors are mobile and we're all mobile, right?
Right.
So doctors sometimes prefer to get this information
yes.
as an SMS.
You know message. When I asked that, just to save you any more angst here, when I asked that, I absolutely forgot that we communicate screen to screen now.
Right.
So, yes,
right.
of course.
So that's...
So right. how are you doing? How close are you getting to some kind of success?
I feel
this?
Like I'm inching away toward success. But I am... Sometimes I feel like I'm not any closer than I was 3 years ago.
Do you have people who also have defibrillators who are joining you in this?
Yes, I do. And then there I think there are many, it's an uphill battle in every front, including with raising awareness amongst other patients, because a lot of times other patients, and we're not used to having access to information, so a lot of times we don't see the value in it. And so it's been, I've had to do a lot of work.
Okay, so that's a really important point that you're making, and which
right.
is why I asked before, what's the benefit to you?
Right.
So if people know that they can do something active if there is a warning, like, as you say, take another
right.
aspirin.
Right.
Or call an ambulance, I guess.
Right, right.
If they need.
Well, the whole point is also what I would like to know. I mean, these devices are man-made, and there are issues with these devices, and sometimes they fail.
Yeah.
And we've had, in the past few years, we've had several recalls, and several very serious issues with these devices. And we're, in fact, right now going through a big recall with one of the manufacturers. And it is the issue is that the there's potentially a problem with one of the wires, the lead that connects the defibrillator to the heart, and that wire sometimes breaks and fractures.
Goodness. And so, would that be painful?
Well, it could cause the patient. It could be potentially even deadly. Yes,
right.
It could be painful. Yes, because it could cause the patient to receive inappropriate shocks.
Uh-huh.
To the heart,
yes.
Or it could cause the patient to be prevented from getting, from receiving therapy when they would need it. And so so there are many, many issues. And a lot of times the patient doesn't even know, is not aware that the device is failing or has failed.
Sure.
So access to this information in a timely fashion could help patients.
You know, if I were the manufacturer, I would be so torn. It's not so clear that it's to their detriment to have patients know the information. If you're a patient and you have this information, and something is going wrong, you can do something to save your life, and then no one will sue the manufacturer on your behalf.
Right.
So it kind of would work for them in ways also.
I think so. And I think it's the inevitable future, frankly.
Yes,
if you think about it, it's just... I cannot imagine, you know, as we advance as civilization and, and we have more and more devices implanted in our bodies to help us with our functions.
So when we look back at other primitive reactions that are just no longer, all kinds of rules and laws that we used to have that are just ridiculous now.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Yes.
So. So
is this something that the Supreme Court would look at someday if there were a suit?
Potentially, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose they could.
Because people make such an issue about privacy.
Right.
And accountability and.
Right. I think with
disclosure.
Right. Right. So right. I don't know. I mean, I think the last sort of place there I haven't really explored. Is
legal?
The legal.
I was curious about that.
I haven't really, because I figured it's always nicer to solve problems in a nice way if you can, by having a conversation.
Oh, that's funny. So we're assuming that hiring a lawyer is the nasty way.
Well, I think so. I
mean, not necessarily, though.
No, it might not be as nice because we'll be, you know, if
it's combative.
It's combative.
You're,
right. So it's basically saying,
oh, you're such a nice man.
Right. Well, it's just you know, it feels like we weren't able to negotiate this in a nice and an agreeable way, and now unfortunately we have to take these to courts.
Yes.
And to the courts. And that is something that I would prefer to avoid. It's costly.
Right.
Is
it okay for you to say who the manufacturer is, or is that not relevant?
Well, I don't know that it, I mean, I can't say it, but there are several manufacturers, and they all work in the same way. And so Medtronic is the largest manufacturer.
Is that who manufactured yours?
That is the manufacturer of my device. They're the largest manufacturer of pacemakers and implantable defibrillators and implantable loop recorders, which are similar to pacemakers, but they don't deliver therapy. They only record information about somebody's heart.
Now, having it implanted is a surgery, right?
Right.
And so it's a surgery where you, I'm assuming, have to be given a general anesthetic?
Right. Not exactly.
Not.
No,
okay.
Nowadays these are done with conscious sedation.
What does that mean? Sounds interesting.
It means that you are, they give you local anesthetic and they...
that you're conscious but sedated.
And you're conscious but sedated.
You know
what
I thought you were going to get to? That your consciousness sedates yourself. I thought you were going in some whole new wonderful direction.
No.
Like hypnosis.
That would be nice, I suppose.
Yes.
But no, it's...
Okay.
We get drugs.
Yes.
So they give you...
So it's not painful? Is it painful afterwards or...?
It is shortly after the implant. It feels like you have a billfold under your skin.
Oh, I was wondering about that.
So it's not very pleasant for a few days, but eventually you get used to it, and it really doesn't bother me as much anymore. It's been 4.5 years, and it's
and you're not limited in any way.
Well,
that you weren't before with this condition,
right? There, supposedly, they say. It really is, the device is there to rescue you in case there is a bad rhythm that could put your life at risk, like ventricular tachycardia, for example. But it is so it's either that or I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. I wondered if you were limited in any physical activity in any way other than right. you were before with a condition that required this.
Right. So
you can do everything that you used
supposedly,
to do.
Yeah. Right? So but one of the things that I keep in mind is the fact that imagine this, the fibrillator has two wires,
right.
two leads. They call it leads or electrodes. They're mm-hmm. they're complex medical devices in on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They're pliable, very delicate little wires with electrodes at the end or metal contacts,
mm-hmm.
and they are threaded through the veins and placed inside the heart.
Oh,
and they have little tiny corkscrews at the end. They're anchored on the inside of the heart. So one of the wires gets anchored on the apex of the heart, into the apex, into the right ventricle, muscle of the right ventricle, and the other is in the atria. So one goes through the valve, through the tricuspid valve,
mm-hmm.
and so the heart beats at least 60 beats a minute. So you can imagine that these wires...
For everybody, at least.
Yes,
that's our, yes.
Right, so sometimes some people might have a little bit higher resting heart rate, but it's, 60 or 70 beats a minute. And when you exercise, your heart rate might go to, 90, 100.
Okay, so that's what I wanted to know. Is that a danger for you?
No, it's not really a danger because the device can discriminate ventricular tachycardia from sinus rhythm, which means it can tell when the heart is pumping adequately.
Who invented this?
I don't know
like
who invented it.
Or?
It goes back. Yeah, it goes back, I think, to the 80s, and it comes out of the idea of the pacemaker.
Yes,
somebody had the brilliant idea of putting capacitors into a pacemaker and figure out a way for the pacemaker to deliver.
I'm so impressed with
shots.
That. You must be.
It's
too.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Well,
it's,
personally, I couldn't invent my way out of a paper bag, so I'm just
that.
Really. It's so hard to.
Right, it's brilliant science.
Uh-huh.
It's really brilliant science, and
yes.
I'm grateful for having it, and I enjoy. I am appreciative of.
Okay, that. I want you to remember that you said that. I'm grateful for. Just store that information for
right.
later. Okay.
Right, and the device has saved my life.
You know
allegedly.
That.
Oh, we don't. There's no way of knowing for sure whether that rhythm would deteriorate into a cardiac arrest.
Yes.
But the device intervened 20 seconds into the event.
Oh my goodness.
Which is when you're looking at syncope, you're looking at passing
yes.
out without a efficient heart
uh-huh.
heartbeat.
Now, whatever the condition that required this, you had
right.
as a child, is this something
right.
all your life?
Right. Thanks for asking that because I thought it's important, I think, to mention.
Yes.
Mention. I have a relatively common type of heart muscle disease called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Or
how old were you when you knew this?
37.
Oh my!
Right.
Sorry,
so I had no idea for most of my life, and so the problem is HCM, or hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, is the number one cause of sudden cardiac arrest in people who are younger than 30 years of age. It's often the reason why athletes or young athletes or teenagers die suddenly playing basketball
on the football field or something.
Football
yes.
field. Usually, it's the culprit is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
So. Looking, so how was it diagnosed then when you were 37?
I passed out on BART.
Oh my.
So, goodness. Yeah, I had no idea. And I've always had palpitations, and I've always had, my heart skip a beat. And
yes.
I always thought that
but
maybe.
That is common.
I think it is, yeah, to some extent.
Yeah.
Some extent. So, but you're not supposed to have a lot of them. And
right.
so if
oh,
you're,
I understand that.
Right. So,
so looking back into your childhood, can you now say, ah,
right.
I can see that.
Right.
What do you see when you look back?
Right. Well, I used to think that I was drinking too much coffee as a young adult, or I was too stressed out, or my dad had worked for Nestle for many years, so he knew a bit about nutrition. He used to say, "Oh, maybe it's your diet needs a little more potassium.
Uh-huh.
Have you been eating bananas or
uh-huh.
potatoes?" And so we would try to manage it that way, but we never really thought that this could be something more serious,
uh-huh.
such as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Yes,
and
yes.
with HCM, a lot of times the first symptom is a sudden cardiac arrest. So I'm
well,
lucky
I can imagine,
in that way
yes.
too.
So what else would you like to say about this? We have really a few more minutes, and you say what is important for people to know. I mean, can I just ask it open like that?
I suppose so. I don't know. I mean, I think I don't want to sound cliche, but you know, I think the message for me has been a very interesting message in a sense of turning adversity into an opportunity.
Okay.
It's a little cliche, but
you'd like some assistance here.
I'd like people
to know. And so, is there a website or so that you would like to give?
Right.
And maybe other people, by the way, with this condition and with a defibrillator, would like to be able to get in touch with you, but also people who have been having these other symptoms and don't know they need one.
Right. So there's a lot of information online. I run a blog called the ICD User Group.
Let's give that website address.
It's icdusergroup.org.
ICDUSERGROUP.org. Okay,
right.
Thank you. It's so important because one letter off and we'll never find it.
Right.
So, okay, right. Perfect. Now just say it one more time.
ICDusergroup.org.
Thank you.
I'm also on Twitter at Hugo OC, and that's my middle initial and the initial for my last name, Campos.
Okay.
Hugo OC on Twitter. And I'm everywhere. I'm not too hard to find. I'm easy to find.
Okay, and Facebook? And
I'm on Facebook.
We can find you. Okay.
You can find me on
everywhere. So please, people, pass the word around. This is important and potentially life-saving.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you so much for doing this. I've learned a lot. This is just exceptional to know what's going on in the medical world and to know what isn't.
Right.
And where people's ignorances are.
Right.
And you shouldn't be a victim of it.
You shouldn't.
Right.
Yeah. Everyone should engage in their care and be your best own advocate, because otherwise nobody else will.
And nothing about me without me.
That's right.
I'm going to have that made into a locket. That's just gorgeous. Okay, so let me ask you something, because I am primarily about letters of gratitude and love letters. And how do you see a love letter? If I were to say to you, do you write love letters or do you get them, what would you say?
I don't think I do.
Right, okay, that's very smart. I don't think I do, because what's your perception of a love letter?
A declaration of love by somebody that loves you.
Okay, right. That's one very wonderful kind. What about the gratitude letters? I mean, my definition is so broad that your truth put to paper in a loving, compassionate, or understanding way counts. Any expression of affection or gratitude, and before you said, I'm grateful for.
Right.
Now, what is it you were grateful for? Because I want to say who would get a love letter today from you.
Right.
And I hope you go home and write one. Okay, so who would get one?
Well, I think I write love letters to other patients like me quite often. People reach out to me with questions about their care.
Ah.
People reach out to me with questions about their device. They're trying to learn. They're trying to get a grip on their health.
So people do know where to find you and that they can find you.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful.
Right.
Okay, so love letters of encouragement.
Right.
That's
right.
A very important kind.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've in workshops that I've done and even here on this talk format, people have written beautiful letters of encouragement of all kinds.
Right.
Okay, and encouragement and empowerment, and those
right.
are definitely love letters.
Right.
But what was it you were grateful for? You said you were grateful to have this
right.
Device.
It's an interesting thing, because at first when I was diagnosed with HCM and I ended up getting the device, I felt very unhappy about it, and I was very distraught and upset, and I thought, and I was very depressed.
Because why me?
Because I felt like I had taken all the steps to be to care for myself, and I felt it was really unfair for somebody who is, you know, it's just the things
that
you go through, right?
And it is.
Right. But then life is not always fair,
that's right?
That's right,
exactly.
So what was interesting was that I had this epiphany, and I don't know how much you want me to get into, but I'm not a religious person by any stretch of any kind.
I know, I like epiphanies. I'd like you to get into it. Yes,
right.
Go ahead.
So, but I'm not by far, and I'm not religious,
mm-hmm.
and
And, which means that you don't practice something regularly.
Well, I mean, I suppose that you could say I'm not a non-believer. I'm a non-believer.
I'm
atheist of sorts.
Okay.
And so, but I did get a gift from a family member, which was a cross. As I was in my moments of despair the darkest moments of my depression, I was shortly after getting the defibrillator within a month. And that cross sort of made me realize, in a way.
That's what I want to know.
Right.
What?
That I was not being brave, that I was not being courageous in accepting my fate. In the same way that and it is one of my interpretations of the crucifixion. It's in the same way that Jesus had accepted his fate, and not comparing myself, but it was a lesson that I took out of that moment, which was a moment of realization that I should accept the inevitable fate of having to carry that cross.
That being my
heart disease, and that being my device, and every other unpleasant things that would be thrown my way. So,
and by the way, look at something huge came out of Jesus's accepting that fate.
Right.
My goodness.
Right. Right.
Runs out the world. So accepting your fate, as you said before, can turn a negative into a positive.
Right.
Down the line.
Right. And it really was that of accepting your fate in life, in accepting the bad as much as you accept the good, and not fight it and not complain about it.
But learn how to use it.
But learn how to use it and make the best out of it and love it. Because,
good for you.
And really love it.
I thought you were going to say something totally different about the cross. You know, assume nothing should be the other watchword. I thought you were going to say, being given this cross, you said, made me realize, and I thought you were going to say, made me realize that I'm not alone.
Right.
Religion notwithstanding, but that you belong to a group of people who will care about you.
Right, right.
I thought you were going to say that.
Right, that's right. I had a little more, slightly different interpretation of it, but this is...
very different, Ben. Yours is wonderful and interesting. Right. And I'm just wondering, I already want to write two love letters... Just listening to you, I want to do one to the manufacturer that says essentially, I'm so grateful that I have this.
Right.
It has probably saved my life.
Right.
Here's what I'd love you to do for me and the rest of mankind.
Right.
And then say what you want in terms of information being available.
Right.
I think that would be a really powerful letter.
Right. Yeah.
And then, of course, you could put it on your blog and send it all over.
Right.
And that is putting your best self on paper,
right?
Which is, I think, a big part of a love letter. It's also saying what you want to say in a really loving, compassionate way. These people are on your side, basically.
Right.
They're just trying to protect themselves also.
Right. Right. I agree with that, yeah.
And the other person is, of course, I'd like to write a love letter to the person who gave you the cross.
Right.
Is that person still in your life?
Oh, yes. And I love her dearly. She's she's my partner's sister. And,
oh, okay.
And yes, and I've told her about this.
Okay.
And,
so you've told her about it. It's wonderful. There is something about having this declaration in your own handwriting on paper that when she's 80, she can look back at this letter from you and say, "I did something good for this man."
Right.
Really?
Yes.
And maybe her nieces and nephews or children or grandchildren or a stranger will find this letter. But also, I'm big on historically important.
Right.
And what you're doing is historically important. Anybody who leads a battle, you know, has a place in this world historically.
Right.
That would become an important historical document down the ages.
Right.
The man who led this march towards... information being accessible. I think you should do it.
Okay.
Thank you for doing this with me. I'm so interested. I've got about 30 more questions and we don't have time. But I want to thank you so much and I wish you well and
I hope
the world joins in.
Thank you.
So this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now and please remember that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, writing a love letter is not only a special occasion but an important important tool if you have something you want to accomplish. So until next time, bye-bye. I wish we had more time. This week. That's great.
Was it interesting?
Yes.
I think I can get a little...
Oh, you know what?